Hello and welcome to Main Engine Cutoff. I'm Anthony Colangelo, and today we are talking about in-space manufacturing, a big topic for the future of space. If you want to do anything interesting in space, you're probably going to have to make some structures, some hardware in space whenever you get where you're going. And we've got a great guest to talk about it today. We've got Andrew Rush, the CEO of Made in Space, the company that you think of when you think of in-space manufacturing. They've been doing a lot of work on the ISS the past couple of years, and they just got a big NASA contract for an upcoming mission that's going to be really exciting to watch. So we're going to talk about the history of Made in Space, the current projects they're working on, Arkonaut 1, and the future of Made in Space in general. It's going to be a great talk, so we'll call them in a second. But before we do that, I want to say a huge thank you to everyone who makes this kind of show possible. Head over to mainenginecutoff.com/support if you want to help support the show. There are 305 of you supporting this show, including 40 executive producers of this episode of Main Engine Cutoff. Chris, Pat, Matt, George, Brad, Ryan, Jameson, Nadim, Peter, Donald, Lee, Jasper, Chris, Warren, Bob, Russell, John, Moritz, Joel, Jan, David, Grant, Mike, David, Mintz, Eunice, Rob, Tim Dodd, the Everyday Astronaut, Frank, Rui, Julian, Lars, Tommy, Adam, Sam, and 6 anonymous executive producers. Thank you all so much for your support and for making this episode possible. Helps me do things like this interview and continue to grow the show. So if you want to help support it, head over to mainenginecutoff.com/support. Thank you all so much. Now, let's give Andrew a call. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me on the show. I'm very excited to talk about Arkonaut, all the other things that you've been working on lately. How are you doing?
Doing wonderful. It's a pleasure to be here.
We were talking a little bit before I hit record about your recent visit. Jim Bridenstine was, I guess he was at your facilities, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome to see. So I've got some links in the show notes to check out. Everybody was tweeting about it as well. So what's that like to have the NASA administrator, who's been at the center of a lot of media in the past year, what's that like to have him on site at your facilities talking about your current work?
It's a real honor to have the administrator come visit us. He's a really engaging gentleman, and I was really impressed with how much he sought out essentially every member of our staff that was there and talked to them and engaged with them and, you know, wanted to know more about them and their backgrounds and what excited them about what we were doing at Made in Space and Arkonaut 1 and all the other projects we have going on. So it was a real pleasure to host him and to talk about, you know, the history of Made in Space, how we've worked really closely with NASA to get where we are today, and the sort of the vision for the future for, you know, doing in-space manufacturing and how that really meshes with Artemis and the other goals that NASA has laid out for itself in the relatively near term.
Boy, you are one for segues, because that's exactly what I wanted to ask you about. So I guess you got some practice with the NASA administrator before coming on the hard-hitting podcast here.
He's a master of you know, segues. So
so let's start with the history of Made in Space. I think a lot of people are familiar with Made in Space in terms of the work that's going on the ISS, but I'd love to roll the clock back, you know, years before that even on how things got to where they are today with Made in Space.
Yeah, absolutely. So Made in Space was founded in 2010, actually. So we're about a 9-year-old company, which makes us a relatively old dog in commercial space nowadays.
Totally.
The founders of this company kind of came together around the vision of how do we enable people to sustainably live and work in space? And that's evolved into, you know, us focusing on how we can, you know, enable and incentivize, the kind of permanent settlement of space. And very quickly, what we came upon is that manufacturing is this really key piece to that puzzle, that we need to develop new tools and technologies to enable satellites to function more effectively, be designed and optimized for their operational environments rather than just to survive launch, and to be able to, you know, provide tools and fixes for humans on spacecraft in orbit, as well as to utilize manufacturing in the microgravity environment to provide economic incentive for us to go and stay. Because really, that's the way that we've opened every frontier historically as humans, is that there was an economic motivator for us to go, you know, to go and branch out to these new locations. You know, we went west to California, not because California is beautiful, even though it is, but because there's you know, there's gold. There was gold like in the rivers that people could pick up and take back and trade for a life of luxury and you know, profit. And that's really, you know, that's a really big motivator for, you know, for a large portion of our business is focused on space naval manufacturing, is finding those, you know, those metaphorical, rivers of, rivers with gold in them. So we, we started off with the kind of foundational technology of just demonstrating any ability to do manufacturing of useful objects in space. And, you know, the founders of the company, you know, bootstrapped it, demonstrated on a flight opportunities, parabolic flight, the ability to just manufacture a little bit, do a little bit of 3D printing. And that was enough to get, you know, to get the broader NASA community's attention. And then through a series of SBIRs, we were able to design and build and ultimately launch the first 3D printer, the International Space Station, in 2014, and, you know, manufacture the very first functional objects off the face of the planet. And that was actually less than 5 years ago, which for us as, you know, folks in the space community is like the blink of an eye, right? And so it's really wild to think about. That's where we were, you know, 4.5, 5 years ago. And now that machine's like 2 or 3 generations old. We have a 3D printer that we own and operate on the space station, as a kind of machine shop in space that if NASA or university or another aerospace company or another space agency wants to manufacture something or needs a tool or fix on the ISS and they want it quickly, they can just call us up and we'll print it for them.
Yeah, the tool thing was one of the first applications that made its way into headlines. There was a ratchet and some wrenches and things like that. What else is happening with that today on the ISS? What is the typical demand like for things that need to be printed up there?
Yeah, so we've printed almost 200 objects on the space station, and they really run the gamut in terms of what they are. We've made covers and fixes for scientific equipment. We've made structural elements to hold and stabilize things. We've made medical. We've made things for, you know, medical applications like finger splints. We've also made a lot of we've got a lot of STEM interest. So we've made tools and models that have been designed by students to, you know, get them thinking about, you know, designing for microgravity, not just designing for, you know, for 1G. So it really runs the gamut, and we've been really impressed with the community's response to it.
Finger splints is pretty good. Is there a particular astronaut that is known to be clumsy that needed a finger splint, or is that something we can't talk about?
It's actually something that's a fairly common occurrence, is that folks get up there and maybe push off a little bit too hard and jam their fingers by running into things. And so that was a really interesting project because we demonstrated the ability to kind of iterate a design very quickly. Like, we made a first design and it was tried out, and then we made some tweaks to it to make it, you know, both more supportive and more comfortable for the subject. I think we actually have a pretty cool picture or two of it being modeled, on the space station.
Modeled in terms of wearing it or actually 3D models. Yeah, I'm not sure even which one you're talking about. So one of the, you said you have multiple generations of printers on the ISS today. And I think people have a general idea of 3D printing in 1G, but maybe not so much in 0G. And that's obviously one of the biggest challenges with adapting 3D printing to the space environment. So those different generations, were the iterations more of refinement of technology? Did you have any complete, you know, let's throw out all the plans that we had before and redesign this entirely? What has that transition been like through the generations and then maybe up through, you know, your next project of Arkonaut?
Yeah, so the approach that we've taken at Made in Space to technology development is, you know, a very iterative approach, a very step-by-step approach. So, and that's paid a lot of dividends, and that we haven't had to sort of throw the book out and redesign everything, you know, everything fundamentally. So the approaches that we took to traverse and extrusion all the way back to flight opportunities, you know, parabolic flights, have been infused really throughout our technology development. The main differences between the two printers on the space station, the first one was, you know, it's the size of kind of a bread box and it lives inside of the microgravity science glove box on the space station, which is a nice enclosed, contained environment that the astronauts use for a wide variety of scientific experiments. The second generation printer we made prints in a much wider variety of materials compared to that first printer. And it's a standalone device. It's got its own environmental control system in it. It's completely enclosed. Because as I'm sure you know, any manufacturing process has a certain amount of off-gassing or other materials that it's generating during that manufacturing process. And it's important for us to protect the crew and the spacecraft from that material. So we want to capture all that and not let that into the main cabin. And so that plus additional material was a big focus for the second device, our added manufacturing facility. But the underpinning technology there, that ability to do 3D printing and microgravity, really remained the same foundation, all of those. And now, we're moving into manufacturing and assembling satellites on orbit. And that has a few key pieces. One of those key pieces is the ability to manufacture in microgravity. Another key piece is being able to manufacture in the vacuum of space. And then you need to be able to assemble not only what you've manufactured, but you want to integrate that into your spacecraft, as well as integrate prefabricated components that are easier to launch than to manufacture on orbit, in order to have a satellite that can manufacture and assemble itself on orbit in a space-optimized way, rather than designing for that launch environment. And that's really where we are today with our very first satellite mission that we're calling Archinaut 1. Archinaut is our manufacturing assembly technology that we've been working on for many years, and 1 is the very first mission.
Maybe a precursor to that I wanted to ask about. I got some questions for you from the supporters of the show. I always give them an opportunity to send me some questions if they've got any for our guests. And some of them asked about the stash and deploy program that was talked about a couple years back, where the idea was there would be, you could probably explain this better than I could, but you would keep components up on the space station and then print to order, maybe a CubeSat or something like that for deployment at a later date. I'm wondering how much of that, if anything did come of that you could talk to, or if the direction you're heading with Archinaut, where you would build the entire satellite, if that's indicative of maybe where that ended up.
So Stash and Deploy is a really interesting service, and you did a great job of highlighting how it kind of operates. There's two really cool benefits of Stash and Deploy. One of those is being very, very responsive. That right now, if you came to me with a perfect CubeSat and a big pile of money, it would take at least a month for me to get that satellite on orbit, just because of launch license. And that's kind of unfortunate when you're trying to be responsive. Like if you have a constellation that some satellite malfunctioned, you need to fix that. You need to fill that hole. You want to do it as quickly as possible, not wait around for launch licenses or whatever. The other way that this is really interesting and provides this great benefit is again, it's another way of cracking the making a spacecraft that didn't have to survive launch loads, so that we devote more of the mass to our functional capability rather than simply structure. And we can also have a configure physical layout that is, again, more optimized for the mission rather than, fitting inside of like a containerized launcher or something like that. We've done some good development with actually multiple partners on that capability. We have not yet fully demonstrated end-to-end the Stash and Deploy service, but we'd be very excited to.
Yeah, and I think there's a significant overlap with what you're talking about with Stash and Deploy, because, you know, with Arkanaut 1, you are going to be building the structure of a large solar panel. But then Project Arkanaut down the line, you might be expanding to producing different pieces of the satellite. But, you know, until you are able to completely produce a satellite in space, you're going to need some components that are either the smaller electrical components or things that, you know, the printer just doesn't do yet. So it's kind of a very logical progression where it's what can we produce in space and bring the other pieces along with us to plug in where we can't yet. So to that end, I'd love to talk about Arkanaut 1 itself before the full Project Arkanaut. You're going to be producing a fairly large solar array, or I guess the solar array themselves would be rolled up in the satellite, and you'll be producing the support structure there. Can you talk a bit about that being the first project that you're picking off for the Arkanaut series? Why is that a good fit for right now? And how do you see that, you know, playing out beyond this particular project, maybe in the commercial market in the next couple of years?
Yeah, absolutely. So Arkanaut 1 is fundamentally a definitive demonstration of the ability to manufacture and assemble in space. We chose the specific configuration of Arkanaut 1, you know, manufacturing and assembling, you know, 20 square meters of solar array on orbit, because we felt it was really important to show something, to show a tangible, useful application of manufacturing assembly technology in the space environment. And one of the things that we're always looking for more of in space is more power and more surface area. And so that's why Arkanaut 1 is focused on the, you know, manufacturing assembly large solar arrays. But even if you take the solar arrays, you know, away, we're going to be demonstrating the ability to do assembly on a very small satellite. Probably the smallest, I think probably the smallest satellite that's ever had a robotic arm on it. As well as, you know, doing manufacturing of multiple, like, large spars. We're going to make, you know, 2 10-meter long spars with our extended structure added manufacturing technology. So all of that, you know, in the package of Arkanaut 1, you know, the package itself is really important. You know, the ability to provide, you know, 5 to 8 kilowatts of power on a small satellite, and that's, you know, that's a significant bump over what's currently available in the marketplace. And small satellites, you know, can mount nowadays. They can mount really, you know, power hungry sensors that are relatively small. You know, that don't their masses, you know, and the profile that we can fit on small satellites. But the small satellites today just simply can't provide enough power to run those. And this really breaks that paradigm. We're going to be able to provide the amount of power that, you know, that large, you know, geotelecom satellites were providing, you know, have been providing in geo for, you know, for decades now on these small satellite buses, and really, really making them less power constrained.
So the one thing there that is a question I've had is the difference in, I guess you're trading volume for mass at a certain extent. Is that accurate to say? Because you're producing a satellite or a solar array that maybe couldn't fit in the volume area that you've had previously, but you do bring along extra mass of the thing that produces your structure, the raw material that you need to produce that. So what is that trade-off like in terms of this scale and even larger than that?
Yeah, good question. So the structure itself that we're manufacturing is actually less massive than you know, a traditional deployable structure, both because we're manufacturing to, you know, to not have to survive launch loads, right? Like the filament, you know, is in a configuration that's very densely packed at launch, and, you know, doesn't really care how many G's you subject it to. And once we get on orbit, we're going to manufacture almost Gossamer-like structure that, you know, would not survive launch even if you folded it up. But we do have the robotic assembly and manufacturing kind of plant that's on there. And that plant though is what really enables, you know, us to make these really complex structures in a volumetrically efficient way, in a mass efficient way, and also in a cost effective way. That, you know, if you wanted to deploy that kind of size of an object, that would be prohibitively expensive. on small satellites. So even from a kind of state-of-the-art perspective, and considering and saying, hey, you know, maybe this, you know, looking at the mass, you know, looking at mass constraints here, we're still coming ahead for the customer from a capability and a cost perspective, which at the end of the day, that's what, you know, that's really important. You know, the dollars per capability, you know, per unit capability that we get to space. Now, extending this a little bit further, when you get into bigger assets, obviously the more things that you're manufacturing assembly, the more you're kind of amortizing the mass of the manufacturing system across the different subsystems that are being manufactured and assembled. So even in small sets, we can be very, you know, almost mass neutral compared to traditional ways, you know, traditional deployable ways that you might accomplish things, because of how many hinges and everything that you need, per unit length. But certainly on like larger assets, you know, we see more and more mass and volume savings in addition to, you know, availability and cost savings.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mentioned a little bit about the robotic arm that would be part of Arconaut 1 and Arconaut in general. That's something that I feel like flies under the radar here, because that's a project all on its own, the complexity of that robotic arm. And I've done shows. I went down to NASA Goddard last year and talked to them about the satellite servicing they're working on with these very complex, large robotic arms with several different tool types. And there's some other companies working on that as well. Is there anything with the robotic arm that is involved here with manufacturing that you could talk about? Or is that kind of the secret sauce?
So the robotic assembly is definitely, as I laid out earlier, is definitely one of the key pieces of Arconaut. And our emphasis has been on cost-effective system. We can deploy on small satellites in a cost-effective way, because, you know, it's not realistic to build, you know, a $20 million arm and put that on an ESPA class satellite. Like that's kind of
defeats the purpose of this.
right. That's the cost of a whole satellite, right? so we've been focusing on architectures and approaches that allow us to leverage a lot more of sort of modern developments in robotics to provide reliable but very cost effective systems.
One other thing that I'm wondering about with Arconaut 1 itself, and then I want to ask you some questions about Arconaut in general. I've got a 3D printer sitting next to my desk here, and I am not a professional by any means, so I tend to waste a lot of filament. I'm curious if you have a certain amount of material kind of as overrun material or extra material in case something goes wrong with manufacturing, and how you plan that out in case, you know, something unexpected happens in the environment of space and you need to reproduce one of the pieces of the structure. Do you have enough to print extras, and what do you do with the excess at that point?
So this is actually one of the unsung heroic developments of the 3D printers that we have on the space station. That 3D printer that you have, you know, in your home, you're right. We all waste a lot of filament.
Me more than most. Don't be too nice here.
But you probably also have to do a certain amount of maintenance to it. Taking care of it, and if it was a little bit more of a larger professional unit, like we have some in our shop, you might actually pay somebody to come by on like a yearly basis to just do maintenance on it, replace things or get worn out, and just keep the machine in really good working order. We don't have that luxury on the space station. We asked NASA if they'd fly us up to the space station and let us maintain it once a year, and they politely declined. So we had to make printers that you could run for years without doing maintenance on it. And that extremely high reliability that we have in those printers is also the kind of design paradigm and knowledge that we're infusing into the extended structure added manufacturing device that's in Arconaut And for that reason, we're pretty confident that we won't have misprints on orbit.
Well, that rocks. I hope that makes its way into my one that's sitting next to my desk at some point in the future. But all right, so that's Archinaut 1. That's producing, you know, a piece of a satellite off of itself. The Project Archinaut in general, you have a site that kind of lays out a bunch of different visions for this, and this is more of a free-flying spacecraft that is able to produce all sorts of different structures. I would love to hear where that kind of is. Is that still in theoretical development phase, or is that something that is kind of actively worked alongside Archinaut 1? Where are things at with that today?
Yeah, so Archinaut, the way we conceive of it is it's really a platform technology that can come in a wide variety of form factors. And there's maybe two branches. There's maybe two main branches of the tree. One branch is a satellite that has a manufacturing plant built into it that uses that manufacturing plant once that satellite gets on orbit to build large extended structures or finish itself. Finish deploying itself in a space optimized way, and that's in the future. Those systems will be designed to not only manufacture themselves, that manufacture the initial configuration of the satellite, but to also, in response to customer need or some other external force, to reconfigure themselves or to repair themselves. That there was some damage done to get us more to almost go from expendable satellite to reusable satellite, to go from kind of fire and forget. We put the satellite up there, it unfurls itself, and that's its configuration, to more of a paradigm where it's up there, it can reconfigure itself, it can augment itself, as long as you're providing it, obviously, the raw materials to do so. And to be more of an immortal satellite rather than something that's only up there for 10 or 15 years. The second branch of the Archinaut tree is that vision of a factory in space that perhaps it lives in one orbit and manufactures to order satellites on orbit that meet customers' needs. And if you had a few of these factories in space, you could provide assets in a very timely fashion, to provide global coverage. That's one of the really fantastic features that we're diligently working on. And we're very proud to have NASA's support via public-private partnerships and other mechanisms, as well as other customer support. But that one's still a little bit far off. But that's definitely one of the areas that we're working toward.
Yeah, and that seems like a really kind of mindset shifting project in its own right. I was joking with a friend before this that at a certain point when talking about in-space manufacturing, you get to the question. That's similar to why not make the whole plane out of the black box? Like, why ever launch a satellite that doesn't make other satellites? Is there that kind of inflection point in the future, or do you still think that's way far away at this point to consider never launching a spacecraft that was built on the ground?
So Archinaut and a few of the other initiatives that we have here at Made in Space and what other folks are pushing on with regard to space manufacturing are all working toward putting more infrastructure in space so that we can, so that we're expanding our economic influence, expanding humanity's presence beyond Earth. And the more infrastructure you have, it's almost like this very positive feedback loop. The more you have, the more you want, it just kind of keeps building. So absolutely. We will have, I think it is in our future, in our, within decades, that we will have, this amazing amount of infrastructure in space that you won't be talking about building satellites, and completing them on the ground and folding them up and putting them in a launcher and launching them to space. And then unfurling them. you'll send piece parts to space and do finishing there, and then release those assets. So it's almost like going from the horse and buggy to the automobile. Eventually the automobile will completely supplanted the horse and buggy. And I think that satellites that are that are manufactured on orbit or finished on orbit, will eventually completely supplant, the totally finished satellite that's launched from the ground.
Yeah. And I think you've kind of shown us how, in some instances, it makes a lot of sense, even today, to do that, where you're talking about the fact that you can build structures that only exist in zero G, that don't need to be able to withstand 1G or any other environments for other than what they're built for. And that kind of specialization is something that, when you think about building out infrastructure in space, seems so important, because that's what we do here on Earth. We specialize to the applications. We don't have to make this thing that survives every environment we could possibly think of. But to that end, I'm curious if you have, I see a lot of the images on the site here are free-flying spacecraft in space, but I'm curious if you have any inklings towards manufacturing on other planetary surfaces, and how what you're working on now might play into, a future out there in different gravity environments, in different atmospheric environments, and if that's something that is on the roadmap for Made in Space.
Yeah, we absolutely want to build, roads and commodes on the moon for human exploration and settlement of the moon, not only the moon, but then, feeding forward to Mars and beyond. Remember our vision is a very, human settlement focused vision, and our roadmaps and our objectives here are to develop as many manufacturing technologies as possible to enable that infrastructure that lets people sustainably live and work in space, including on other planets and other moons. So absolutely, our 3D printers on the space station work in 1G and 0G and fractional G. So taking those printers and putting them on the moon and using those to prepare the sites for human occupation, and also keep the habitats going and repaired and in good order, is absolutely on the roadmap and part of our ambition.
So that's obviously, it kind of lays out a timeline of things based on where the industry in general is at. But I'm curious, in your own kind of personal vision for Made in Space, Archinaut 1 is due to launch in 2022, I believe. That's the current schedule. So that's, 3 years out. I'm curious what you see Made in Space working on 5 years from now and 10 years from now.
10 years from now, I hope that a significant fraction of satellites are designed around an in-space manufacturing assembly capability that's based on Archinaut. I think that, again, to use the kind of horse and buggy and car analogy, like this is the car, right? It's usefulness once it's going is obvious, and I think the industry is hungry for these sorts of innovations, because there's so many missions that we have ambitions for that will just be prohibitively expensive and extraordinarily difficult and risky to do absent some in-space manufacturing assembly capability. 10 years from now, I also firmly believe that we're going to see space-enabled manufacturing of multiple products be scaled to the point where you'll have commercial space stations, commercial space station modules that will be steadily manufacturing goods in space that will bring back down to Earth and sell into the commercial market. Really expanding the pie of launch, expanding the pie of human utilization of space, and being, those tenants in those commercial space stations alongside NASA, and really establishing establishing a low Earth orbit, a commercial low Earth orbit. And all of that really excites me, because I firmly believe that we just don't know the impact of these new technologies and these new business models I really think we're going to see a wonderful and, you know, almost unbounded economic boom from these, the sort of the e-commerce revolution.
Are there other trends in the industry, be it for launch or even production on the ground, are there other trends in the industry that you see interacting with Made in Space, things that you're excited about, things that you're worried about, anything there that you're looking outward and have some thoughts about that you would like to share?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the launch industry right now is so vibrant, and almost week to week we're seeing new approaches, new service offerings. I really think the next 12 months for launch, for small launch, and for larger rockets is just going to be very, very exciting. And the net effect of all that, from our perspective is really positive, right? More launches and cheaper launches is great. We'd of course love to see more return vehicles to bring stuff back. That would be really nice. And one thing, a potential storm cloud on the horizon that I think everyone's done a really good job of keeping at bay is whether or not we're going to stay committed to the amazing amount of space technology development, the pace of space technology development that's been occurring for really the last 5 or 10 years. Commercial cargo, now commercial crew, the incredible investments that space tech mission director at NASA has made, all of these things are really enabling this new renaissance in this beautiful community of ours, in a way that I think it, like lots of folks, lots of folks that were around for Apollo even say, hey, this is like as exciting for, in this community as it was then. And that's, you just kind of have to like pinch yourself and just feel so grateful to be a part of that, to be witnessing that or being part of this right now. But we of course will face setbacks, right? Both as companies and as a broader community. And I hope that we can continue to have the courage of our convictions and say, hey, yeah, that's a part of the process. It's to borrow a line from, Magic School Bus, get messy, make mistakes. That's what we're doing. But it's yielding these amazing results, right? Like the Falcon 9 is a great example of that. They've had their own, their own trials and tribulations, but like, look at the impact that has had on the industry. And in Made in Space, sometimes we miss schedule. But we ultimately like overcome that and deliver great systems and show these new capabilities, as do many, many people in the industry. And, I'm really excited about the level of commitment that we've seen, within the community, and even on Capitol Hill to these development of these new paradigms.
You've appeared on Capitol Hill a couple of times. This was something that I was thinking about in the run-up to the interview. I'm curious if you have thoughts on what that process was like, preparing for an appearance there and actually, being there to give your perspective. Is that terrifying? Is it exhilarating? Where are you at on that?
It's really, I think that kind of ties back to what I was mentioning a little bit earlier, that it's really awesome that these folks that that our senators and our members of Congress are so interested in, in innovation in the space industry that they invite, somebody like myself from really small company like Made in Space to share our perspectives, and to kind of tell the story, and to highlight how the programs and processes that NASA and DARPA and the industry really as a whole have consciously and unconsciously put together, that we've been able to use those to accomplish real things, to show real progress and to do real technology demonstration and development. It's really exhilarating for those, you know, to have those folks be interested in what we're doing.
My second to last question here, I'm looking over my notes for things that I might have missed talking about, but this maybe does play into politics a little bit. It has come up a couple of times in the last few years, and certainly on the technology side it has as well. In-space debris is something that many people are talking about these days. There's a bunch of different technology development in progress right now to capture debris. I'm curious if you've got any ideas in that direction of being able to reuse the material that's up there and maybe produce something out of it. That seems like something that would be a pretty rad futuristic project, but I don't know if it's something that, you know, Made in Space has the time to focus on yet.
Yeah, certainly reusing or repurposing assets on orbit is something that we like to think about. Sometimes those thoughts are over, you know, pizza and beer. But it's definitely an exciting area to consider, you know, going forward. And I think it's just a question of when will we see real interest in that? Because there's some, the technical challenges are like totally fascinating, right? It's not only, you know, identifying where the asset is, but there's the rendezvous of prox ops, and then there's the actually figuring out if the material is what you think it is. And then you have the kind of verification back to the customer of saying, hey, you know, I said I was going to make this thing out of this alloy because I thought this alloy was on orbit and I found it or I didn't. And here's the proof. It's a really fascinating problem. And I do think that as we build out this infrastructure first in low Earth orbit and then further out, those sorts of, you know, futuristic applications will become realistic far, far quicker than I think we imagine.
Is there anything else that I should have asked you about either history, future, current status of Made in Space that I didn't bring up here on the show?
I don't think so. I think you covered the waterfront quite well.
Nailed it. You're the first one that I nailed it on. I don't know. Everyone else is always like, I had this one thing that I really wanted to talk about. So I'm glad that we covered the gamut. I'm really, really excited to have had you on, Andrew. I'm very excited by the projects that are happening on Made in Space, and I'm excited to follow the next few years as you get closer to launch with Archonaut 1. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Huge thanks again to Andrew for coming on the show. It was a real treat to have him on here and talk about doing work in space. We have been on this tear recently of talking to people that are actually making use of all the cheap launch that we tend to talk about here on the show. So it's always good to have somebody on that's doing the work up there, making use of that cheap launch. So thank you all so much for your support. If you're out there supporting the show, you make this all possible. Thank you all so much for your support. If you want to help support the show, mainenginecutoff.com/support and do it there. If you've got any questions or thoughts, email them to me, Anthony@mainenginecutoff.com. And until next week, thank you for listening. I'll talk to you soon.